أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله أشهد أن محمدا رسول الله
As-salamu alaykum. Peace be on you. We're back for another episode of Islam in Focus, dealing with our current series on the sources of Islam. Today, we'll be examining the topic of the Bible as a possible source of the Quran. I'm your host, Hamid Rashid, and I have joining me on the program, as usual, Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Mary's University. Brother Jamal, as-salamu alaykum.
Wa alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah.
I wonder if I could have you very quickly highlight the main points that we touched on last week when we began this examination of the Bible as a possible source of the Quran.
Okay. Well, the first point we tried to clarify last time is that any similarity between the Bible and the Quran, or any previous scripture for that matter, does not necessarily mean that the more recent copied from the one that is older, because both scriptures could have based this information on the same original source, that in that case the divine revelation, both came through Allah himself or God. Secondly, we indicated also that the recency or relative recency of the Quran in fact is an advantage, because as the Quran indicates, it came as the criterion or a revelation from God, from Allah, to supersede previous revelations, confirming what remained intact, correcting interpretation that might have not been totally correct throughout history by followers, and giving a comprehensive guidance to human life on earth. However, we said that if we were to make any comparisons or comparative study between the Bible and the Quran, we have to keep in mind that there are some essential differences that we discussed in some detail last time, in terms of the whether it's all revelation, partly human interpretation, when and how were these things written, are they available in the original language in which the Prophet uttered and so on. And likewise, we tried to point out to some of the common errors which sometimes non-Muslims or Muslims themselves even make in equating some of the Quranic terminology of previous scriptures like Al-Zabur, Al-Tawrah, and Al-Injil with the usual translation of the Psalms, Torah, or Gospels, or even in some cases with Old Testament or New Testament, and try to indicate that these are not necessarily identical, and that the Muslim obligation to believe in previous scriptures or holy books revealed to these prophets refers to the original revelation given to these prophets, not to biographies written by their followers about what they taught. So the main thing really was to show the theme that what appeared in the Quran is quite independent as a set of revelation coming from Allah or God, both in terms of the creeds contained in the Quran as well as matters of history too.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to focus in this program on the questions of on the question of creeds that are contained in both of the books.
Okay.
First, I'd like to ask you how the conception of Allah or God, capital G, compares in both books, and how this comparison confirms or disconfirms, in your view, the claim that the Quran was influenced by the Bible.
Okay. Well, let me start first with a basic point of similarity, because, of course, we don't want to overemphasize differences, nor do we want to brush them aside. But at least that much seems to be reasonably common between the beliefs of Jews, Christians, and Muslims, all biblical and Quranic type of approach. And that is the belief in one true, universal, compassionate, almighty, just creator and sustainer of the universe. Whether it's called in Arabic Allah, or whether some see that as God, capital G, it's not that material anyway, even though the word, the term Allah is more accurate for reasons we explained in a different program. But basically, there is that common ground to start with. from. But also, to be honest and frank about it, there are also some points which are basically different. And the first thing that strikes any student of both scriptures, at least the Muslim reader, is the notion of anthropomorphism in the Bible, or to put it in a simpler form, the way the Bible depicts God as if he were a man, a sort of superman or superhuman, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And the evidences of that are quite plentiful, and this point alone actually shows that the Quran could have never been influenced by the Bible, because there is no parallels like that in the Quran. For example, in the first book of Genesis, in chapter 1, verse 26, we are told that God created man in his own image, or after his likeness. And that, of course, leaves the reader with the impression that God is just like a human, because man is created in God's image. I am aware, of course, that some may claim that image here means spiritual image, because God is not material. But my feeling is that this is more of a apologetic or questionable response, because of at least three reasons. One, this statement of saying God created man in his own image does not only appear in the first book of Genesis, or the first chapter. It appears as well in chapter 5, also in the book of Genesis, in the first verse. It repeats the same thing. And interestingly enough, this is the same term or expression used to refer to the son of Adam, Seth, S-E-T-H, because it also says that Adam got a child in his likeness after his image. So apparently the usage of the term seemed to imply the physical image. Second reason why the notion of spiritual image is not very strong or convincing response, really, is that the notion of Allah or God looking or resembling humans might have indeed contributed to the notion that emerged later on in the New Testament of Jesus being the God incarnate, or God in human form. And we all know that this type of interpretation has been influencing the thoughts of many Christians throughout history. The famous artist Michelangelo, for example, in his depiction of God as an old man with Jesus as a younger man by his side, seemed to show that this was the more common interpretation of what image of God really means. And the third reason is that in the other quotations that we may discuss or refer to, we will find that this notion of anthropomorphism, or thinking of God in human terms, is not only in the first book of Genesis, in the first chapter of the book of Genesis, but it is repeated as well in many other contexts. So maybe perhaps you can take a few more that might show what exactly is the main difference. For example, in the third chapter of the book of Genesis, from verses 8 to 11 in particular, we are told that when Adam and Eve ate from the forbidden tree, they hid themselves in the bush or the trees,
yes.
And then they heard the Lord walking, or the voice of the Lord walking in the freshness of the day in the garden. And they hid themselves, and of course he started calling them, and he told them, you know, where are you? They said, we are, naked. He said, how did you know that you are naked? Did you eat from the tree? Now, the implication here seems to be quite obvious. How could Adam and Eve hear the voice of the Lord walking in the garden unless the image of God here seemed to be more of like a physical being moving around and making that noise? A third related point is found, for example, about the story of Prophet Noah. When the ark settled on Mount Ararat, in the book of Genesis, in chapter 8, verse 21, we are told that he offered a burnt offering. And then it says that the Lord smelled the sweet savor that again a human image to smell, for example, the meat being roasted or burnt. Fourthly, we get the impression also from reading the Bible that God is like a human. He forgets, he might need someone to remind him, and he might have to move from one place to the other in order to find out what is going on. A quick reference to that, for example, is in the 9th chapter of the book of Genesis, verses 14 to 16, when it talks about God, or about a bow in the clouds, so that God remember his covenant. Or in the book of Genesis, chapter 18, verse 21, of God going to Sodom and Gomorrah to find out what people are doing. A fifth related point, which is quite essential, I believe, is the notion that God needs rest like we humans need. For example, in the second chapter of the book of Genesis, in verse 2, we are told that God created heavens and earth in 6 days, and then he rested. And that is the origin of the term Sabbath. And we'll come back later to the question, concept of Sabbath, from the scientific standpoint. But that seems to me an indication again of superhuman, but still basically like man, or man-like type of God. Sixthly, before the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, we are told in the 18th chapter of the book of Genesis, in the beginning, that the Lord appeared to Abraham and he sat in the tent door in the heat of the day. That again seems to be more of a human description. A seventh point is that there are times when the Muslim readers, for example, get the impression from reading the Bible that God is like a human. He forgets and regrets and does not know what will happen in the future and just gets surprised at things happening. And this is clear, for example, shortly before the story of the flood in Genesis 6, verse 6. The same kind of notion was repeated when God thought to punish the Israelites because of their infraction, as you find in the book of Exodus, in chapter 32, in verse 14. And these seven examples I just gave to show this notion of anthropomorphic configuration of God, or thinking of him in a human form. In fact, there are other things that a Muslim reader may find or notice in the Bible which seems to indicate that God is not only a human-like, but that he sometimes even is worried, as if he were competing with the power of the humans, who sometimes even prevail over him.
Mm-hmm. Could you explain this perhaps a little bit further? Are there references which could be checked to examine that statement?
Well, going back, for example, to the book of Genesis and the basic famous story of Adam and Eve, we are told, for example, in the second book of Genesis, in the second chapter of the book of Genesis, verse 9, that the tree that was forbidden to Adam and Eve was the tree of knowledge. Mm-hmm. Distinction between right and wrong, or good and evil. And that we are told also that when they ate from that tree, one of the main reasons that God didn't like their behavior was that he was afraid that the human may become one of us, quote unquote, as it appears, for example, in the third chapter in the book of Genesis, particularly verse 22. That, in other words, the human is just like God now, because he knows right from wrong. Whereas in Islamic understanding, the knowledge of right and wrong, good and evil, is inherent in human nature before eating from the tree. So eating from the tree was a reason, or was a result or consequence of that human nature, and not the reverse. Not only this, in the same chapter, chapter 3 in Genesis, in verses 22 through 24, we are told also that God was worried that after Adam and Eve ate from the tree of knowledge, they may move on and eat from the tree of life, and as such live forever. And it says there that God placed a flaming sword which moved in all directions, or every way, in order to keep the way of the tree of life, a sort of protection, if you will. Similarly, in the famous story of the building of the Tower of Babel, that appears, for example, in Genesis chapter 11, verses 5 to 9, that God came to look down to look into what man has built, and he was worried, or more or less indicated that the humans now, or the human race, is one, their language is one, and now they can do everything, or nothing that they want to do will be, they will be restrained from being. And then he decided to confound their languages, and that's the source of the term Babel. Mm-hmm. He confounded their languages so that they can't understand each other. Well, again, that might seem to indicate a sort of worry in the mind of God that the human power may be competing with his might.
Mm-hmm.
A third example, which is actually the reason why Jacob was called Israel, is the famous story depicted in Genesis chapter 32, especially from verses 22 on, where it says that Jacob, when he was alone one night, he wrestled with a man, and then he realized later that this man he wrestled with was God himself, was the Lord, and that actually Jacob prevailed over God in that wrestling, even though at one point God, or that wrestler, the other wrestler, touched the hollow of the thigh of Jacob and caused it to get out of joint. But in any case, Jacob seemed to have come up triumphant in this kind of wrestling match, and God blessed him that night. And it was also indicated that God told him that from now on your name shall not be Jacob but Israel, because you have power with men and with God. Well, I mean, these are three of the indicators that the perception or conception, if you will, of God in the biblical way of presenting it seem to indicate a sort of human-like nature, which is subject to the same basic limitations that other humans have, which is it's quite different.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, in the answers to the last two questions, you gave numerous references from the Bible. How do the references that you've just been discussing compare with the Quran?
Well, as far as the Quran, we find that while the Quran emphasizes the individual, intimate relationship between the human and the Creator, we find there's also parallel emphasis on the transcendence of the Creator and his dissimilarity from anything that he himself had created. And in that sense, we can say that the concept of monotheism in the purest form, called Tawheed in the Quranic terminology in Islam, is quite different in some respects, some important respects, I should say, from the New Testament, the Old Testament. It's quite different from the notion common among Jews or Christians, for that matter. I can only give you some references to some. I just mentioned some briefly, and perhaps analyze a few that perhaps might provide more material for those who wish to examine it. The Quran, for example, does not have any notion whatsoever of quote-unquote God incarnate or God becoming man.
Mm-hmm.
We find references to that in 930, in 4169, in 7677, in 1519, and numerous other places in the Quran where the basic emphasis again is that Jesus, peace be upon him, was a human being, was a great messenger and prophet of God, and the notion of Trinity or God becoming man is absolutely untraceable in the Quran. But in addition to this, if you compare, for example, citations in the Quran with some of the points that were raised earlier, we find that, first of all, the notion of anthropomorphic God, God in a human-like form, has no parallel at all in the Quran. Indeed, to just give a few references, in chapter 42, verse 11 in the Quran, it says, لَيْسَ كَمِثْلِهِ شَيْءٍ. There is absolutely nothing which can be compared or similar or resembles God. In chapter 6, verse 103, Again, it indicates that vision or thinking or thoughts cannot comprehend God, but he comprehends all vision, all thoughts. In the 112th chapter in the Quran, they say he, Allah, is the one and only. Allah is the eternal. He is independent or self-sustaining. He begets not, nor was he begotten, and there is absolutely nothing or none that is comparable unto him. You notice again that this basic notion of the transcendence of the Creator and being dissimilar to any creature, human or otherwise, is consistent with other citations in the Quran that shows that he does not need rest or sleep. For example, in the second surah in the Quran, in 255, indicates that God does not take or get overtaken by slumber or sleep. In chapter 42, verse 11, the same kind of thing emphasized that he created heavens and earth without, you know, feeling tired or having felt any exertion, which we as human feel it, but he doesn't. There is no question at all in the Quran, or no problem or any notion whatsoever of God being worried about the increasing power of the human. In 36:82, for example, in the Quran, we are told that his command, if he willed anything, is simply to say to it, be, and it is. So how could the Creator of heavens and earth be really worried about power or knowledge or strength of humans? It's totally nothing for him. The question of the knowledge of God, that he does not regret, does not discover something, the Quran indicates that his knowledge includes the past, present, and future. A couple of references that could be checked on that, for example, is 2, 5 and 6, and 6, that's Surah 6, verse 59. These are all related to the same issue. Maybe we should add also here a point that would be relevant when we make a comparative study, is that in the Old Testament, in the Bible, God is depicted many times as a tribal type of God.
Yes.
The God of Israel, for example, so much emphasis on that. In the Quran, from beginning to end, there is no single incident where the Quran speaks about Allah or God as the God of Quraysh, that is a tribal God for the Arabs, as opposed, for example, to the God of Israel, nor the God of Arabs or God of Muslims. Always speaks about God or Allah as the universal God of all humanity, of all the universe. From the first surah in the Quran to the last surah, the same emphasis on him as Rabbul Alameen, Lord of the worlds, Rabbul Nas, Lord of humankind. To be brief, just to conclude this series of citations, the main point that is being made here is that there are fundamental differences in the concept of Tawheed or monotheism in the Quran as you compare it with either or New Testament, and that these differences are not just casual differences that, you know, it's similar here and different there as if there is no consistency. In fact, the Quranic concept is presented with a great deal of consistency and tightness that shows that it's totally independent in its structure and formulation from either the Old or New Testament or both of them together. It's perhaps the purest, most profound, yet simple conception about the Creator that could be found anywhere.
But I'd like to shift to another aspect of belief, and that is the belief in prophets. What similarities and differences do you think are related to the question of the Quran borrowing from the Bible?
Okay. Well, let me start first from the point of similarity. In the both Judeo-Christian as well as Islamic view, there is agreement that God or Allah chose certain human beings or individuals and revealed his will to them through scripture, and, you know, put them in charge of communicating that message to the rest of mankind. I think that much perhaps would be a point of common common ground, if you will. In the Quran, however, we find that, unlike the Bible, the prophet is not presented as someone who simply has the power of prophecy, someone who can prophesy what will happen in the future. This is regarded as a minor function, really. The Quran depicts the Prophet as in charge of receiving the message of God, communicating it to people, exemplifying the message also, and showing people how to do it. The other thing that strikes any person making a comparative study is that the concept of a prophet or messenger in the Quran seems to stand between two extremes. The extreme that one finds, for example, in the Old Testament, by way of attributing major moral sins and even shaky creed and belief to the prophets on one hand, and the other extreme that the Muslim reader may find in the New Testament by exaggerating the importance of human beings or prophets to the point of deifying them or considering them as, you know, God-man type of notion. And I consider that to be a significant and important difference.
Mm-hmm. Could you give some specific examples and as to why you consider the differences an important one?
Well, because two things are, you know, easily detectable by a Muslim reader, let's say, of the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
One is that some prophets are accused of having some kind of compromise in the matter of belief or faith in God.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, some prophets are accused of certain major moral sins which one would not expect even from an average reasonable individual.
Mm.
The examples of the first one is the famous story of Prophet Aaron, the brother of Moses.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And we are told in the book of Exodus, in the beginning of chapter 32, that when Moses went to Sinai to receive the Torah from God, that it was Aaron actually who collected the gold from the woman and, you know, made it into a golden calf. The Quran say, you know, makes it clear that he's innocent of this kind of story. In the case of Prophet Solomon, who is regarded in Islam as a prophet also, we are told in the first book of Kings, in chapter 11, verse 4, that towards the end of his life, his wives made his heart being turned away from God and somehow inclined to the gods,
mm-hmm.
plural, the gods of his wives. As far as the question of the moral sins attributed to prophets, which the Quran does not accept, does not mention at all. Going, for example, to Prophet Abraham, we are told that he told or claimed when he went in the Pharaoh's land in Egypt that Sarah was his sister, resulting in the fact that Pharaoh actually took her and was just about to, you know, consider her as a concubine or something of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
And that appears, for example, in the 12th chapter of the book of Genesis, particularly verses 12 to 16. And the problem is that the same kind of behavior is attributed to Prophet Abraham when he went to see the king of Gerar, G-E-R-A-R, and that's again in the 20th chapter of the book of Genesis, that again he claimed his wife to be his sister, and actually the king took her, and again was about to commit the same kind of problem, a mistake. The other example of this, a contemporary of Prophet Abraham, Prophet Lut, and again his story with his two daughters is quite famous. I don't feel like going into details in a program like this, but anyone wishes to check that can read the book of Genesis, chapter 19, verses 30 to 38, where a very major moral crime was attributed to Lot. It was attributed in the same chapter also that he gave his two daughters to the people of Sodom and Gomorrah to do with them as they please, just to save his guests. The same thing was mentioned, or similar moral infractions were attributed to Prophet David and his story with the wife of Uriah the Hittite, that he committed adultery with her and used all kinds of deception to conceal it. That's found in the second book of Samuel in chapter 12. And this is quite different really from the way the Quran depicts those great personalities in human history.
Mm-hmm. Another important issue which we may not have time to develop in today's program is the question of sin, human nature, and how to overcome sin. Mm-hmm. How does the Bible and Quran compare on this issue?
Well, perhaps maybe if we backtrack a little bit to the question of prophets, because this might have some bearing on it, it might also pave the way to properly understanding what the notion of sin really means in the Quran and how does it compare with the Bible. As compared with this kind of description that we're given to these prophets, we find that within the Quran there is only all kind of praise for them as individuals who are steadfast in their firm belief in God, in terms of the high moral qualities they possessed. Just to give quick references for further examination, in chapter 3, for example, in the Quran, verses 33 on, in chapter 19 in particular, there's beautiful depiction here about several prophets from verses 41 to 59. So that shows that from the Islamic standpoint, the prophet is really the best model for his people. And if the prophet was a person who could compromise the matters of faith and belief, how could he be entrusted by God to communicate his message to mankind? If the prophet tell people day and night, do not commit adultery, do not steal or lie or deceive, and then he's doing the same thing, then the teaching would not have any meaning or weight as far as his people are concerned. So the notion of a prophet here is considerably different, and that's what's referred to actually as the asma, or infallibility of the prophet. But they are humans, they are capable of committing small mistakes here and there,
mm-hmm.
but to commit such major sins in matters of belief or moral behavior is something that's not really befitting for the prophets and their roles, the great role they played in human history. The Quran presents them as the select of the select, as you find in chapter 6, for example, verse 68, and chapter 21, verse 73, that the prophets are the best models for humankind to follow.
Mm-hmm. Well, on that note, I think we'll conclude our program for today. We want to invite you back next week, and we'll continue with an examination of some historical issues in the Bible and the Quran. Thank you for watching. As-salamu alaykum. Peace be unto you.
I'm